Welcome to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase, our monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. For November, we'll speak with the director of Marshalltown's Orpheum Theater about several events and exhibits showing at the center. We'll learn about guest poet and author Hyde Erdrich, who will present a public reading of her work at UNI's Center for Multicultural Education as part of the North American Review's celebration of Native American Heritage Month. We'll discover what gems the Gallagher Bluedorn has scheduled for their 2015-16 season. We'll hear about a world premiere featuring an internationally acclaimed guitarist who will be appearing later this month at the heart of Iowa Classical Guitar Society's fall concert. And we'll head to Waterloo's Grout Museum District, investigating their 365 and counting Iowans in the Vietnam War exhibit, paying tribute to the 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase. Thanks for joining us.
We have been gratified. We sometimes have been surprised that when people come in, they look at this exhibit and they see things that perhaps we did not necessarily see when we put it up. Whether it is the touching of that dog tag that exemplifies or reflects the death of somebody they knew, or whether it is simply looking at the dog tags and saying, oh my goodness, I didn't understand that 1968 was that bad. I remember it as being bad, but now it makes sense to me. To looking at the cover of a Life magazine or a Des Moines Register and saying, oh yes, I remember that. And it creates in people, it brings out in people a sense of emotion, sometimes to tears, that we want to evoke that sort of involvement, but nonetheless to see a 75-year-old man crying because he remembers that event or he knows the person on that dog tag, that's a powerful feeling. And it also means, I think, that we've done our job.
It can be pretty emotional, I think, seeing how tremendous this war and how divisive this war really was for American culture. Second of all, I think a key component and the real centerpiece right in the center of the exhibit within the bunker is our oral interview project. And we've put excerpts of every Iowan we've interviewed. It's really through their voice you can experience the Vietnam War, how they remember it. And I think it's a real central component here at the Grout Museum District of the way we tell stories. And it's not always just through visuals and text. It's a lot of times through the words of those who experienced it. And to me, that has a real emotional impact of learning about a particular conflict or in a particular experience.
Bob Niemeyer, historian of the Sullivan Brothers Iowa Veterans Museum, along with research and programming assistant Christopher Shackelford. From 1962 to 1975, Americans fought to stop the spread of communism in Vietnam. 115,000 Iowans served in the Vietnam War. Most were in Vietnam for 365 days. Vietnam-era veterans are welcomed home by the Grout Museum District with an exhibit called 365 and Counting, Iowans in the Vietnam War. Bob and Chris fill us in on how they undertook the monumental task of creating a meaningful 50-year memorial tribute to Iowa's Vietnam vets and their families.
The Sullivan Brothers Iowa Veterans Museum tells the story of Iowans throughout American military history. So everything that we do here sort of starts out with the role of an Iowan in a combat or a home front situation. So as we looked at developing a story about Vietnam, it is 50 years that the war sort of began, we would always look at it in terms of the war in Vietnam and what role did Iowa play. And with that in mind, we started to do the research, and we had already had a permanent exhibit, which is still in place. And what we did is we said, how can we expand on that? How can we tell that story more fully? And 50 years ago is a long time.
So how long have you been working on getting this exhibit ready?
Say it's over a two-year process. And about a year and a half prior to the exhibit opening, we got together a group of Vietnam veterans. We tried to hit every branch possible to kind of get multiple different perspectives on how the war was fought and what the experience was like for the individual soldier. And so throughout that planning process, we started getting the different perspectives, what was important, what they wanted to see, and they were instrumental in not only the intellectual property of building the exhibit, but also, you know, volunteering their time and putting in the manual labor of making sure that it's constructed.
Well, not only did you consult with some Vietnam veterans, you also borrowed some of their stuff.
Yeah, a lot of stuff. You know, we put calls out in a lot of local media outlets to make sure that we had stuff from all different branches and exemplary things that they could walk in and recognize it. We were looking for those universal symbols, whether it's as small as a Zippo to as large as an M16 rifle. We wanted things that they would recognize from their service and a lot of different stuff.
What struck me when I saw the exhibit was the organization of it, and how did you decide to put it together and include all the elements that you did?
And really, that was a collaborative process between Robin Venter, recently retired curator, myself, and Dr. Niemeyer here. We really talked through every inch and every component of that exhibit and choosing photographs or choosing the layout, what medium is going to be presented in that different layer of interpretation through the visual components.
Now, the Vietnam War was an interesting time in history. Set the stage for us, Bob.
One of the issues that we had in developing this exhibit was we have a whole generation, several generations, in fact, that are not aware of those emotional moments from 1965 to 1973 when the Americans left. So on the one hand, we're talking to people of an age that remember protests, remember fighting in the field, remember the return of veterans to America. On the other hand, we have young people who probably don't even get that storyline in their high school or even in their college education. So we had to find a way to blend the two. So we've taken the story of the home front and how it impacted the lives of people. We've taken the story of the conflict, in the combat areas or in support of the combat areas, and we've taken those stories and we tried to develop them sort of concurrently. So we have an above the line and below the line. Above the line is telling the broader context, and below the line is starting to get those personal stories, trying to create at least a sense of the emotion that happened between 65 and 73.
And the Vietnam veterans really didn't get a good deal when they came home.
The Vietnam veterans, for the most part, received little response, little respect when they came home, and many of them, much worse, that when they came from the theater into the United States, they encountered protests, they encountered vile language, and even worse. Most Iowans who served in Vietnam when they came home did not experience that in Kelowna or Wachir or Decorah. But what did happen is that they really became almost introverted. They didn't talk about their experiences. And for some of them, because we've done oral history interviews with them, some of them haven't talked about that experience until this past year. And so you go to the family and you say, well, what did John do during the war? And their children or grandchildren will say, I don't really know. He has not talked about that.
In one of the displays, a beret was thrown away and his brother saved it for him. I thought that was very interesting.
That is kind of an interesting story. For the opening event, we had a caterer come in, and his name was Len Swaitley, and he's an Iowan and served on a riverboat as the United States Navy. And he told this story, and he became very emotional. And he says, I think that you guys could really have that beret for a year. This material that could so easily be passed by carries so much emotional value for those who had held on to this for upwards of 50 years at this point. That is a very good story, an exemplary story of how, when they first came home, it seemed, I had to take my uniform off immediately. You heard that over and over in a lot of these oral histories, is I just wanted back into my civilian clothes. I was done with my service. I wanted to be over with it. You know, it's a different conversation now here in 2015. I think they're able to discuss it a little more openly without the stigma that you may have had in the 1970s. And so he's able to proudly display that beret and explain his service and be proud of what he did. And that's just one example of many that we experienced while putting this exhibit together.
Right now, we're so used to being inundated by all these images and things. But during the Vietnam War, this was sort of a new deal where there was so much coverage of the war and people actually could see what was happening.
The Vietnam War was a war that came to us on television with Walter Cronkite talking about the news and what was happening in the field himself on many occasions. So it was the first war that we were really aware of, and you know, many people would argue that it was always a perspective that was negative, that the war was not going well, we were losing the war. Regardless of that interpretation, that is what we as Americans saw during this period of time. So today we see what is happening on a moment-by-moment basis. But back in 1965, 68, 1970, we were seeing things that were still 24 hours old, but the war's not going well. The war's not going well. What can we do? Should we support the war? Should we oppose the war?
So tell us about how this is laid out. And it's kind of interesting how you have things with the different battles and that sort of thing, along with modern culture at the same time.
We have it juxtaposed from below the line of our timeline, so to speak, running along the entire length of the exhibit. Below the line is everything occurring within Vietnam, telling individual stories of Iowans, as well as the major historical events. We discuss policy and policy makers and different tactics along the way. And everything above the line is your global events or events happening back home, including pop culture references, say the most popular songs of the year. This can really tie that together as, hey, I remember when Sesame Street became a popular television show, and at the same time, we're in the Yadrang Valley. It's quite interesting seeing that compared. And speaking of layout, as you follow the timeline, we have placed a dog tag of every Iowa soldier who was killed in Vietnam. 866 Iowans were killed in the Vietnam War, and we've placed them chronologically throughout this time period. So not only does it allow those who know of or family members find the dog tag appropriately, it also adds another level of interpretation in seeing that in 65, 64, there's very fewer dog tags than, say, 68, 69, where the dog tags almost entirely encompass our timeline entirely as the war intensified and more casualties mounted.
This was a turbulent time, and we kind of forget about some of the major people that were assassinated during this time period.
This was domestically, there were the upheaval of the 1960s and early 1970s was going on. The reference to that above the line, those global contexts, those national contexts, sort of helped create a sense within the country that not only was the war in Vietnam going badly, but the domestic situation was not going well as well. Are we in one of those time periods where we begin to think in terms of dramatic transformations in terms of politics, in terms of culture? And so if you lived through that time period, you began to sense that the war was only part of the problem, and that we as a society, it was time to step back, take a look, do an analysis of what was going on. So whether it was Martin Luther King, whether it was Robert Kennedy, whether it was Kent State, whether it was Jackson State, there were a lot of things happening. And so you woke up to a newspaper, when we had morning newspapers, or to Iowa Public Radio, and heard the news, and it was seldom good. And so you always were putting that in perspective. And so always in the background was this murmur of the war was not going well. The body count was this. People were coming home and not happy. Where was our country going?
Tell us about some of this retrieval of Iowa artifacts that you have and some of the pictures that you've tried to display from Iowans who took them when they were there.
It was important to us to show the war through the eyes of Iowans, particularly through photographs. We've done oral interview projects with upwards of nearly 300 Vietnam veterans. And so we contacted each and every one of them, asking them, could we at least have a photograph of yourself during that time period? And if there's any other material or photographs you may have, we would love to be able to incorporate them during this 50th commemoration exhibit. So we incorporated a lot of these photographs that these gentlemen supplied us, sometimes thematically, sometimes historically, sometimes chronologically. And then we do have an ever-developing wall throughout the duration of this exhibit of photographs of Iowans who returned from Vietnam. And this is laid out on a magnetic board. And it's kind of a neat component that allows Iowans to come in here and interact with the exhibit. It's an ever-changing exhibit. It's their exhibit, to be honest. Furthermore, due to a volunteer who brought the project to us, we have been able to present a photograph and biographical information about all 866 Iowans who perished during the Vietnam War, really humanizing this whole event. When they're only a dog tag, sometimes it feels to me as here we just lost a soldier, but we really lost a brother, we lost a son, we lost a friend.
The Grout Museum's research and programming assistant, Christopher Shackelford, along with Dr. Bob Niemeyer, historian for the Sullivan Brothers Iowa Veterans Museum. The Grout's 365 and Counting, Iowans in the Vietnam War exhibit continues through July 16th of next year. To hear more segments from Bob and Christopher's interview, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Art Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. On Veterans Day, all veterans and active duty military personnel receive free admission to the Grout District Museums. On November 10th and continuing through March 12th of next year, the Grout Museum of History and Science will present the exhibition The Belgium Connection, Lou Henry Hoover, Belgium Lace, and the Battle of Waterloo. On the Friday and Saturday after Thanksgiving, the Grout District's Imaginarium will host a Hogwarts Science Academy. To get more details about the Grout District Museums, go to groutmuseumdistrict.org. Please join Iowa Public Radio at 11 a.m. on Veterans Day for an encore broadcast of the Des Moines Symphony's Yankee Doodle Pops concert under Maestro Junta. Governor Branstad joins the orchestra for a special Armed Forces salute. The symphony also presents Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture and several Sousa marches, along with favorite selections from three musicals and Iowa's own Simon Estes performing Old Man River. We also encourage everyone to take part in their local Veterans Day activities. Just ahead, you'll hear UNI's North American Review guest Native American poet Hyde Erdrich reading from her work. You'll find out about the Gallagher Blue Dorn's exciting 2015-16 season. You'll learn about the Heart of Iowa Classical Guitar Society's upcoming Fall Des Moines concert. And we'll head to Marshalltown to investigate exhibits and future events at their Orpheum Theater Center. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
What we really sort of value here at the Orpheum, if I had to break it down into two words, those two words would be intimate and local. We try to feature performers and performance from Iowa or the Midwest, or performance that's about topics related to what it's like to live in Iowa and the Midwest. And we think that that's something that we really are somewhat unique in doing here in Marshalltown and in the area. And the other thing that we really love is our smallness. We have a small movie house, we have a small performance space, and we had a wonderful performance back in February by the University of Iowa Latin Jazz Ensemble. And the director of that group, his comment that, you know, this was like playing in somebody's living room. And we've had that kind of response not only from all of our performers, but our audiences as well. They really prize that great energy between audience and performer. That's our tagline here at the Orpheum. The O is the place where artist and audience meet. And we hope that people throughout Iowa will visit us here at the Orpheum and see what we have to offer.
Michael Oxley, the Marshalltown Orpheum Theater Director. Michael fills us in on the Orpheum's past.
The Orpheum's an old RKO movie theater. RKO was one of the great movie studios of the 20th century, and the Orpheum Theater is actually the first RKO movie theater to open after World War II in America. So it opened in 1949, 950 seats approximately, well known for its fancy schmancy modern air conditioning plant, and showed all the great films here in downtown Marshalltown, along with at least two, maybe three other movie theaters. It was the time, of course, when people were going to movies sometimes on a daily basis, how they got their news, saw the latest film, cartoons, all that. In the middle of the century, of course, towards the end of it, a lot of these great downtown movie theaters, business declined with the advent of shopping malls and multi-screen movie theaters. The Orpheum lost business. It was acquired actually by the same theater chain that owns Marshalltown's 9-screen movie complex. They tried twinning it in the 80s in the hopes that they could show different films and increase their audience. Still, business slowed and the theater itself closed in 2001. It was scheduled to be demolished and either made into a parking lot or a McDonald's. A community group got together at that point wanting to save the theater, and through a lot of hard work was able to raise enough money to actually purchase the property. And then they needed to start a second phase so that they could accomplish either a restoration of the theater or a renovation of the theater. They were struggling to get that done. And at that point, that's when Iowa Valley Community College District got involved. They became partners with this local nonprofit group. They got a fantastic Vision Iowa grant from the Iowa state government, along with numerous foundation grants, and they were able to renovate the theater. So the theater itself doesn't look like it would have when it opened over 50 years ago. It's now part of Iowa Valley Community College District. And so rather than it just being a movie theater, we have a 150-seat movie theater. We have a 150-seat black box theater that we use for live performance. There's a 50-seat classroom that we use for Iowa Valley continuing education courses, as well as renting it to businesses and other organizations in the community for their use. And the gallery is usually exhibiting materials from our memorabilia collection related to Iowans in entertainment. And we do have a coffee shop run by a local business person, Peggy White. It's called Bake My Day Coffee Shop. The coffee shop itself, the space, was part of the original footprint of the building. There are a couple spaces in here, our sort of grand entry lobby, lovely sort of sea green terrazzo marble that we have there. That's all original. When the renovation process started, we had to dig through about 7 layers of linoleum and other flooring, and then we found this and were able to save it for the renovation. And the coffee shop, too, had gone through several uses. And when the renovation happened, we did renovate that and were able to reopen it as a coffee shop.
And you still have your marquee out front, too.
That's right. With a couple of changes to it, the original RKO letters are displayed here in our gallery, but now they say IVCCD at the top. So this is the Iowa Valley Community College District Orpheum Theater. But yeah, we were very fortunate in being able to save the marquee and the original lettering system that was used. We found a company here in Iowa that actually specializes in restoration and treatment of those cast iron plates that are the letters for the marquee. And the main street entrance of the building is as close to what it looked like when it opened as we could. It's the interior of the building that's changed a lot.
Tell us about some of these exciting things that you have happening now in November.
Well, we've just opened an event series in partnership with the Marshalltown Public Library and a traveling exhibition from the American Library Association on the Dust Bowl. And there will be a series of events lasting until mid-December. Here at the Orpheum, Poet Laureate Mary Swander has written a play called Map of My Kingdom, which is about land transfer between generations, which Mary herself confesses that when she was first approached about writing this play, she didn't find it all that exciting. But as she went on and gather some stories, it was actually became quite interesting. So the play itself is told from the standpoint of an attorney who's handling all of these transfers of land, and we'll be presenting that play here at the Orpheum on Saturday, November 7th at 7:30 p.m. And then we'll be showing Ken Burns' two-part documentary on the Dust Bowl. That's on the 21st and 22nd of November. Then the first weekend in December, we're going to be showing Iowa Public Television's documentary on the farm crisis. And the weekend after that, we'll be showing John Ford's classic adaptation of John Steinbeck's novel, The Grapes of Wrath. The library will have numerous scholars and speakers. They'll have a book discussion on a particular book about Iowans growing up during the time of the Dust Bowl and the Depression. And we'll also even have some music and other activities going on there. So that's our first event in November. On November 13th and 14th, we will have our annual commemoration of Marshalltown's own movie star, Gene Seberg. And this year, on November 13th at 7 p.m. and November 14th at 1 p.m., we'll be showing a new documentary on Seberg's life called Movie Star. That was made by Kelly and Tammy Rundle of Fourth Wall Films in Moline, and Iowa's Gary McGee, who's been a lifelong Gene Seberg fan. And the three of them, this has been a labor of love now for about 6 years. Very excited to show that. And back in July was a winner of the Best Feature-Length Documentary Film at the Landlocked Film Festival in Iowa City. Also on the 13th, we will be opening throughout the building an exhibit of our fairly extensive Gene Seberg memorabilia collection. And what we're really excited about this year was a new gift that was made to the collection by Kendall Natvig, a gentleman who taught at Iowa Central Community College and then retired. He, again, is a lifelong Seberg fan, has been collecting particularly movie posters of Gene's movies from Europe. So we got this amazing collection of posters from her films in Turkic and Finnish and Czech and just really fun, amazing stuff. Some beautiful artwork back in the day when posters were handmade. So we have like pastels and watercolors and just gorgeous artwork. So we're very excited to have that new element to our collection. Also photographs, letters, and other materials from Seberg friends, her colleagues, and that will be displayed throughout the building. And then we'll have a concert by Amy and Adams. They're a Twin Cities-based folk duo with ties to Marshalltown. Mark Adams Weston is a Marshalltown native, worked for Gene Seberg's father. The Sebergs owned a pharmacy here in Marshalltown, and they do music from Tin Pan Alley up to the current time, and beautiful harmonies. So we'll have them performing for us as part of the Seberg weekend in our black box, and that's on November 14th at 7:30 p.m.
The Marshalltown Orpheum Theater Director, Michael Oxley. To get more details about Marshalltown's Orpheum Theater Center, go to orpheumcenter.com. Check them out on Facebook or Google Plus, or call their event hotline at 641-844-5907. Don't go away. You'll get the inside scoop on the Gallagher Blue Dorn's upcoming season. You'll find out details about the concert lineup of the Heart of Iowa Classical Guitar Society's internationally recognized guest guitarist. And you'll hear about the creative projects of UNI's North American Review guest native poet Hyde Erdrich. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
Yeah, I think I have some form of artistic or literary ADHD. I really love to switch gears. And I don't think I'm alone in that. I think the idea of genre or sticking to one art form is sort of culturally derived at, and in other cultures there's a holistic notion of art. You know, you both might be a visual artist and a dancer, and you might sing, and you might also produce the words to your own songs from your own ideas, so you're essentially a poet, and you perform. It's just kind of the way art is holistically, so I just, whatever form the creative notion comes to me, and that's what I produce it in. So I've been able to do 4 books of poems. That's the 5th one I'm just finished with. Play, short stories, essays, critical essays, and little poem films recently, which is really fun.
The University of Northern Iowa's North American Review guests Native American poet, video poet, playwright, nonfiction, and fiction author Hyde Erdrich. Hyde grew up in North Dakota in a family of seven. Both of her parents were teachers. She was not raised on a reservation but lived close to several in Minnesota. One of her sisters is a writer and another sister owns a bookstore. Ever since she was a little girl, Hyde always loved to read and write for fun. By the time she went to college, her writing took off. She attended Dartmouth and polished off a double MA at Johns Hopkins University. A true Renaissance woman, Hyde is currently on the faculty at Augsburg College teaching their MFA creative writing program. In addition to her many creative projects, she also collaborated on an anthology.
I co-edited an anthology with Laura Tohe, who is now the Poet Laureate of the Navajo Nation. And it was really fun. We worked with Native women writers specifically on how they viewed themselves in community and how they viewed community. So it's a themed anthology, which is unusual, but it's worked really well. It's been in print for, I think, maybe 15 years now, and it's doing really well.
You've always had a love affair with language, but particularly with Native language. So tell us about some of your projects, and you've worked with your sister on some of these projects as well.
I did not grow up speaking Ojibwe Mwim, the Anishinaabe language. My grandfather was the last fluent speaker in our family, and that was for many reasons, social reasons mostly, also because schools disallowed the use of Native languages. And when I was old enough and came back to Minnesota, where the language revitalization movement was started and was gaining a lot of ground, I tried to learn the language, and I devoted myself for a couple of years to studying and learning the language, and I got a rudimentary understanding. But it's a very complex and beautiful language, and I knew I would never have the fluency that I needed to have. I started too late. I didn't have a way to really gain that fluency without basically changing my entire life, which many people do, and they're wonderful people that they can do that. But what I could do is help contribute in some way. And my sister Louise had been working with an elder to publish his works. We did that book first. And then from that, we formed an organization to support Indigenous language revitalization efforts. And out of that, I started a press with a wonderful bunch of writers, including Anton Troyer, who helped edit many of the publications. And we've made short films from that organization, too. It's called Bigwa, which means birch bark in English.
You also have a wonderful relationship with the natural world. How has that informed your work?
I like to say that it's all one world, and I just maybe pay more attention to the interplay between the non-human living things and the way we look at the world, I guess. You know, I grew up in a small town. I spent a lot of time outdoors. And I live in a city where you can spend a lot of time outdoors. Just came back from a walk on the most glorious fall day you can possibly imagine. Just super beautiful here. And it's just a big part of my daily way of understanding how am I human, reflecting back on the world around us. How does the world around us survive? And how does it work? And what does it try to tell us? And how are we in relationship to these animals and creatures and rocks and water around us? It's my life rather than my subject, I think.
And how does science influence your work?
That's kind of interesting. I don't know exactly how I started to love to read science writing, but maybe when I was at Johns Hopkins, which was also a science school, it's known for its medical school, and there was a history of science program, which is my husband was in that program, and that's how I met him. I just, really love reading how science creates its own metaphors. And I like taking those metaphors and turning them around and looking at how it teaches us about, again, who we are as humans when we look at the language we use, the metaphors that we use coming out of the living world in a more scientific vein. So it just fascinates me. And it became sort of the unlikely and unusual thing that I wrote about was writing about science through my poetry.
Hyde Erdrich will be reading from her works on November 10th at 7 p.m. at UNI Center for Multicultural Education. She'll be in Iowa as part of the North American Review celebration of Native American Heritage Month. This will be her first IO reading, and she already has several ideas about what work she'll be sampling.
Well, I think I'll read a few poems from my book, Cell Traffic, and I might even read a little bit from my what's called a cookbook. I have a book called Original Local, which has, you know, hundreds of recipes in it, but it also has hundreds of short essays and lyric passages where I talk about indigenous foods. So I'll probably do a little bit of both of those things, and then I'll read a couple of new poems from the work that's not published yet.
Hyde selects a few excerpts to share just with us.
I think that I'll read a few poems from Cell Traffic, which was my most recent book. This book is about maternal fetal stem cell traffic. It's about how cells from a mother pass into a child and back and forth and vice versa. It's a very interesting thing that happens. And to me, it was sort of a beautiful metaphor for the closeness you feel toward your kids, your siblings, your parents, grandparents. Literally, we are a part of one another. So I thought I'd write about that. But it's also not necessarily benign. You know, there's a lot of other things that go along with it. They don't know for sure what it does. Is it totally harmful, totally helpful? They don't know. So I'm going to read this little one called Mitochondrial Eve. Children lowered down a well, so dark the stars shine even in the day. They hide, swinging over dank waters, asleep in a net strung tight as a web. They've been there so long, they forget what they fled, who hid them. And then it ends like this. The debate goes for decades, millennia. Then they give in to some subtle pull, a strand of maternal code, thinner than hair, stronger and lasting long as humanity. Something of mother tugging all along. And now they know they felt it always. Danger passed, time passed. They emerge at last, stunned by the sun, wondering why they stayed afraid of such things as enemy or other, wondering what was it made them stay down so long. So that's a little poem about being related at the mitochondrial level to everybody. And then I'll read just a little bit from a poem called Microchimerism, which is about people who are not just one genetic individual anymore. And here's, this one's kind of the end of the poem. Nub of human, shell, pink fingernail, who left cells in your mother that she gave to you, a million unknown others? What makes us our own soul and sovereign selves is only partially us. The search for God can be called off. Now we know masses of genetic material not our own, inside us, always with us, like the soul. I should not have said that about God. Forgive me, I am not myself. So those are little poems that are, you know, about the science writing. You know, most of my poems are not like that, but I was working through my understanding of that work.
And you're going to have different styles of your poetry that you'll be reading then on Tuesday?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'll read some of the poems. A lot of my poems are meant humorously, and I perform them so you can kind of see me make little gestures to be amusing. And then some of them are more about the information I'm trying to convey. Yeah, they have a lot of variation, I think. Sometimes I write about my kids, but not in a way I think that is about what they do, but how I perceive them or what I think about their future. I have one that's called The Anachronism Fair. I'll read that one. It's sort of like, you know, a Renaissance fair, only I wanted it to be generic, so I call it The Anachronism Fair. Wonder of a man balances on his bald head, iced in massive aquamarine blocks, yes, but with thin sculpted figures, too. You children hear droplets, smell what straw, dust, crowds, sweat and water mixed makes of a hot country day before you throw your lives into light boxes, sensory deprivation tanks for the masses, me too, who float here, all eyes and ears, all nostril flares shut off, no huff, no whiff, in the great round now, where our senses grow obsolete, anachronistic, curiosities for other futures. Wonder of it all, child, will be how you'll know your need to breathe when at last you two meet, the one you'll pull like breath, your lung gasping stuff. You're not enough. You're not enough. So that one's more, it's a new poem, not in the previous book. So thank you. It's fun to read these to you.
The University of Northern Iowa's North American Review guest Native American poet, video poet, playwright, nonfiction, and fiction author Hyde Erdrich. Hyde graciously agreed to read for us. Hyde will be reading from her works on November 10th at 7 p.m. at UNI's Center for Multicultural Education as part of the North American Review's celebration of Native American Heritage Month. This event is free and open to the public. In the fall 2015 issue of the North American Review, Hyde also curated a suite of Native American poetry. To find out more about Hyde, please see her website at hydeerdrich.com. To hear more from Hyde's interview, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Art Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. Just ahead, a world-class guitarist performs in Des Moines, and the Gallagher Blue Dorn rolls out their 2015-16 red carpet season. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
I like to think that we're actually celebrating the next 15 years. So sort of building off that 15-year history and taking the best of it and moving it forward. And we're doing something a little different this year in that we're adding some shows as we go. And so on December 10th, we'll be announcing some new shows from our hand-picked series. And this is a series of shows that really focus on independent music and young audiences. So for folks 20 to 35, these are really neat, independent, sort of hip shows. And we'll be announcing two then and how to interact and get involved in picking out the next two that we do. And then we'll also be doing some shows over the summer and late spring that we'll be announcing somewhere around Christmas time as well. Again, great shows that you'll recognize and people that we've been working on for years and years. And what we're trying to do is be out there looking for opportunities a little more and adding more shows as we go. And there are acts that we can't book a year and a half out because they're too busy. They make decisions too close to the actual performance dates. So this enables us to go to a whole bunch of different people we've never been able to bring or include before. So it's kind of fun.
The Associate Dean of Special Programs and Executive Director of the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center, Dr. Steve Kerrigan. This year marks the center's 15th anniversary. The Gallagher Blue Dorn's 2015-16 season has already kicked off. Steve fills us in on their incredible November 16th concert.
The Danish String Quartet was just a natural for us. These are young men who met at string camp when they were about 13 or 14 years old, and they've been playing for about half their lives. They're just under 30, but they bring a great youthful exuberance and also a deep love of their heritage. I think it's three Danes and one Norwegian, and so they play a lot of Nordic work, and they bring so much energy. And of course, they perform some of the traditional core repertoire too, but there's just this liveliness of it and a lack of pretense. They really just sort of bring you the music and bring it with energy. So we're really excited about them. We are doing our special chamber staging where we actually put the musicians sort of in the midst of our audience. And so there's a real intimacy and connection with the performers. And so when these guys bring their energy and our audience brings its enthusiasm, it's just going to be a great night.
That's going to be on Monday, November 16th. And then you're going to do a Buck a Kid family show.
Right. We're doing the Nutcracker Ballet. It's of course, a Christmas tradition. And our Nutcracker is really kind of fun because we wanted to combine sort of the family experience of engaging local artists and local folks in it. But we also wanted to maintain the quality by bringing in a national company. And so what we did is we partnered with the Minnesota Ballet. And we bring those folks in and they've done the choreography, the sets, the costumes, and of course, all the principals and lead dancers that are technically very demanding, we bring those folks in for. But then the children and even some of the small choral parts where there's real significant dancing done, we audition all over Northeast Iowa, and we're going to be having about 110 kids participating. And when I say kids, I mean up to high school kids. In fact, one of the dancers coming back with the Minnesota Ballet is one of our Northeast Iowa dancers who danced the Nutcracker here as a local and then auditioned and got into the company. So that's a really fun transition.
And that's right before Thanksgiving on November 21st and 22nd.
Two matinees, so perfect for the family.
And you have a couple of holiday shows. Tell us about those.
Well, we have Home Free coming, and Home Free is an a cappella vocal group. They won a big reality TV show, The Sing-Off, and they are doing a mixture of contemporary Christmas and non-Christmas music, but also some very traditional stuff. And this, of course, with five guys singing multi-part harmonies and things. And so I'm looking forward to it a lot. I think it'll be a really good show.
And then on December 19th, the big band shows up.
Right. The big band Christmas is a really fun combination of sort of out-of-town talent and local talent, because we're bringing a wonderful singer, a chanteuse. She's going to be performing with her dad, Bill Shepherd, who's a UNI emeritus professor who's had a big band here in the Cedar Valley for a while. Of late, he's been especially working on Frank Sinatra tunes, and he has a wonderful, wonderful interpretation of Frank's songs. And so he and his daughter are going to sing sort of a whole bunch of music as well as instrumental music in that big band format. So it should be really, really fun.
And that's going to be on Saturday, December 19th at 2 p.m. in the afternoon.
Nice afternoon. I think we're even going to let people dance.
Tell us about this other string quartet that you have coming with a pianist. This is exciting.
Yeah, this is a wonderful combination of performers, and bringing Andreas Klein, who's actually been in our community before as a pianist. He's a remarkable, remarkable soloist. So we really are looking for that piano quintet sound. So it's really a neat night of chamber music, because it's sort of chamber music plus, quartet plus.
And that's going to be on February 5th. And then Little Orphan Annie's going to head to the
Gallagher. You know, it's just so delightful. And of course, it's so family friendly. And it captures sort of the American story of optimism and anything can happen.
And then one, of course, NPR's favorites.
Right. And of course, Garrison just announced that he's retiring from the show yet again. But Garrison Keillor has just a wonderful, wonderful delivery style. He's a remarkable storyteller. Actually, one of the great American writers right now, and a great poet as well. So, yeah, that's going to be a remarkable evening. I can't wait to have it.
And he's coming on February 15th. Annie was on Valentine's Day.
Valentine's Day. I know. That's going to be quite a weekend.
I guess. And then you have another musical that is a Tony Award winner.
Okay. And this is Once, and it's probably my favorite musical of the season next year. It's just sort of an achingly beautiful show. It has a song called Falling Slowly in it, and I urge everyone to listen to that song. It was actually made it onto Top 40 Radio, which is very rare for Broadway shows nowadays. But it is just an achingly beautiful story that it tells, which really is almost a small version of the whole story of the piece, which is a love story. It's just a beautiful, beautiful night and very, very romantic. But also, the music's very, very beautiful.
And there's two performances, 2 and 7:30 p.m. of that on February 21st. And tell us about this Zuzu.
Oh, Zuzu, it's a European dance movement puppetry group, so it's interdisciplinary. They do what I call concept dance, which is sort of telling stories or having an idea central to a piece that's movement. So they do a lot of work with giant puppets and costumes. They do a lot of work where they tell a story or even try to provoke an emotional or humorous response. Perfect for the family.
And that's on February 26th. And you're going to polish off the season with a hometown girl. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we're going away to come home again. And so we're bringing this wonderful singer, Emily West. And Emily grew up in Waterloo, Iowa, and went to high school and wanted a professional career very badly and had a great voice to start off with. So she went to Nashville right after high school. And she was there and she had a little success, got a record label and started to do a little work. But it just didn't quite go over the tipping point, didn't quite make that hit. And so it fell back and she was having kind of a tough life. And then she heard about this television show, America's Got Talent, and went and auditioned. And turns out she got in. And she had this sort of fresh makeover start with lots of coaching and different kinds of music. And it turns out all that talent that she had the whole time just needed that new place to come to fruition. She was the America's favorite. She didn't win the contest, but she was the second place person and the audience favorite. And what she brought is this beautiful, beautiful voice. She does some original music, but she also does just wonderful, wonderful covers of great music. She's got this wonderful, crystal clear voice, a really sharp band, and she's really just kind of starting. So this is her first big national tour. She's just starting to hit the road in this new phase of her career, and she's got an album coming out with Sony, a major record label that's hired her, and she just does these wonderful, wonderful performances of music you know and love. So it's this wonderful full circle experience where she goes away, has hard times, overcomes. There's an American story in this somewhere where you overcome adversity, you seize that opportunity, and you come back home to perform for your family and friends. It's going to be a great night.
That's on April 29th, and I could see that selling out just because of the hometown.
It's going pretty fast.
Yes. Well, not only do you have this marvelous season, but the Gallagher is home to your Kaleidoscope series, the School of Music, and the WCF Symphony. So you are occupied all the time.
If you want to see a show, and many of these are very low cost or free of cost or dollar, take a look at the Gallagher Blue Dawn calendar, and you'll find not just the Gallagher shows, but many shows, the Symphony, the School of Music. There's literally something pretty much every single night. And you can come and hear some of the greatest classical music in the world. You can hear great pop music. You can see opera. You can see string quartets. You can see piano soloists with nationally quality performers. And of course, you can see your friends and neighbors playing in the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony with their beautiful, beautiful music and their great artistic leader, Jason Weinberger. So there's so much that happens in this space. We're so lucky to have so many talented artists sharing their talents here, right here in our community.
So how can folks get more information and get tickets and the whole nine yards?
Well, we try to give them multiple directions for doing that. The best way is, of course, to come to our box office at the Gallagher Blue Dawn or at the McLeod Center over in the athletic complex here at UNI. But if you're too busy to do that or if you live out of town, you can go right to our website, dbpac.com or unitix.com, and order tickets, and you'll actually have the opportunity to see the exact same screens, the same tickets are for sale that those student employees would also be able to access for you. So you don't lose anything and you get a little more convenience. What you miss out on is a little of the advice, but still, every seat's a great one, so you can do that. And then the middle ground there is you can call at 273-7469 and you can speak to one of those same great employees and they will take you through and ask you the questions that make sure that you get the experience you want to have at the Gallagher Blue Dawn.
The Associate Dean of Special Programs and Executive Director of the Gallagher Blue Dawn Performing Arts Center, Dr. Steve Kerrigan. Other Gallagher Blue Dawn events this season include the UNI Opera Theater's presentation in January of Carlisle Floyd's Susanna. In February, The Price is Right hits the Great Hall stage. In March, the original host of National Geographic's Dog Whisperer makes a guest appearance. The Letterman perform and the comic Brian Regan appears in early April. And The Illusionists, live from Broadway, present Thrilling Magic on April 26th. Just ahead, an international guitarist heads to Iowa. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. The Heart of Iowa Classical Guitar Society will feature internationally acclaimed virtuoso guitarist Adam Levin in recital. That's on Saturday evening, November 14th at the Capitol Hill Lutheran Church in Des Moines. Adam grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. His dad gave him his first guitar and lessons at age 7. In high school, he would start practicing at 5 before school started. He received psychology, pre-med, and classical guitar performance degrees at Northwestern. He went on to finish his master's at the New England Conservatory with Elliot Fisk. Utilizing a Fulbright and other scholarships, he studied in Spain for 3 years, exploring 21st century guitar music. In 2008, he commissioned 30 new Spanish composer solo classical guitar works. Currently, Adam is the co-director of the annual Boston Young Guitarist Workshop. He also teaches guitar at the Universities of Massachusetts and Rhode Island, as well as Middlesex College, and concertizes across the globe. He gives us a quick peek at the works he'll be playing at his November 14th recital.
I will be playing music across the centuries, from the Baroque period all the way up to 21st century music, and I'll be playing works by Eugene Isai, who was not a guitar composer. He was a virtuoso violinist and composer of the early 20th century, and I was fascinated with one of the works he wrote for solo violin, and I robbed it from the violin for an arranger for the guitar. Then I'll play a Loose Suite by Bach in E major. Then I'll be playing two pieces back-to-back that are theme and variations. One of them is from The Late Renaissance by Frescobaldi, beautiful work that Segovia transcribed from keyboard to guitar. And then I will contrast that with the work that I commissioned by this wonderful Spanish composer, Ricardo Llorca from Alicante. He's on faculty at the Juilliard School, and he wrote a work based on Handel's opera Xerxes, and specifically the aria Vago Dendo. So we have both past and present together. And then the second half, I'll be exploring works by Mario Casanuovo Tedesco, who's personally quite relevant, not only as an immigrant from Italy, but even more importantly, is a Sephardic Jew. He left Italy in 1939 to escape the dictatorship of Mussolini and became a very famous and prolific composer in Hollywood, and also was the composition teacher to Henry Mancini and John Williams, Star Wars. And then I'll play a world premiere of a work called Jamanja Sonata. Jamanja was the Brazilian goddess of sea and humanity, and that's a work that was written by a composer who's really dear to my heart, Eduardo Morales Caso. He's a Cuban Spaniard. I met him in Spain during my Fulbright days, and he was actually the first composer that I contacted, and that has been a very significant friendship to me. And then finally, I'll finish with something a little more familiar and play works by Joaquin Turina, the famous Spanish composer, and play something that's very familiar, the Fandanguillo and Saviana. So it should be a really fun and diverse recital. I'm excited to present a new world premiere. That'll be the freshest it'll ever be, and share it with this great audience. And it's going to be just exhilarating. It's going to be my first time in Iowa, so that'll be fun.
So how can folks get more details about you, Adam?
So you can learn a little bit more about me and follow my travels and where I'm teaching and so forth at adamlevinguitar.com. I also have a fantastic violin and guitar chamber music group called Duos Unidos, which is something that I've been working on for the last almost 10 years collaboratively with a violinist, William Knuth. And we have sort of forged new territory with this instrumentation, violin and guitar, doing fresh transcription music that was originally for voice and piano or violin and piano for violin and guitar. And I just launched within the last 6 months a new nonprofit called Kithara Project. That's K-I-T-H-A-R-A Project. And basically our mission is to bring the guitar to areas with limited access to music and music education. And within the last 6 months, we have launched two flagship sustainable programs, emphasis on the sustainability. And we are really excited about where it's going. It's going to be something that changes lives. We started our one flagship program in Mexico and the other one in Boston within the last 2 months. And hopefully audience members out there can check it out.
The Heart of Iowa Classical Guitar Society's internationally acclaimed virtuoso guitarist, Adam Levin. Adam will perform in recital on Saturday evening, November 14th at 7:30 p.m. at the Capitol Hill Lutheran Church in Des Moines. To find out more about the Heart of Iowa Classical Guitar Society and Adam Levin's November 14th recital, please go to heartofiowaguitar.org. To hear more from Adam's interview, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Arts Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. Today's Iowa Arts Showcase November broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Production thanks for this show goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner and Phil Moss. Program research was provided by Rachel Berenger. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Happy Thanksgiving, and thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org. org.